This is the Lean Into Art Cast.
Whether it's illustration, cartooning, UI design, or presenting, it all comes down to telling your story, communicating your ideas. But it ain't for the faint of heart. But let's lean into it.
And it says that it's recording, which means that we can give this another go, Rob. I'm crossing my fingers.
Okay.
So
I think I might minimize. Well, I do want to see what you're doing. Speaking of which, person I haven't said your name yet, Jersey Drozd of leanintoart.com and comicsaregreat.com.
That's me. And then that guy over there is Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and leanintoart.com. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Jersey.
So we're going to do some drawing today for this video episode. We're going to try to do some drawing today.
We may be a little skittish because we are hoping our technology works and we're crossing our fingers. We've had a few hiccups, but I feel good about this run. I think this is going to be it. This will be the Lean Into Art episode 29 right now.
All right. Call. What's that?
I said I'm calling it.
Ah, I see. So you're being brave.
Yeah, as if my gumption and attitude has any effect on the technology. But it's fun to pretend.
Yeah, just going back to our episode about control, the illusion of control.
It's totally the illusion of control.
So yeah, we're gonna give another video episode a try, and you know, we'll see. One of the fun things we wanted to do with this podcast series is alternate between audio discussions and then video demos of things while we discuss something. And I think Rob, you proposed this topic, the idea of doing picking some things that we have trouble with and discussing how we figure our way out of them or not. Could be something that we're still having trouble with.
Like, well, and specifically when, you know, with drawing as opposed to, you know, an untrustworthy kitchen appliance or whatnot. It's when there's some subject matter of that you're trying to draw convincingly, and you know, you get stuck, and obviously you have to deal with it. I mean, if it's in a comic that you're putting out weekly, I bet you may have, you know, some approaches that help you just cope, maybe. But then, you know, sure. I think there's other things there too. I know some battles for me are actually fairly fairly extended challenges that are ongoing. Just kind of jumping into it. Clothing, fashion. It's tough as far as like dressing my characters and coming up with sort of outfits that are convincing and interesting and more relevant than just sort of, you know, everyone's got the nondescript t-shirt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of which I am having some really severe performance slugginess on my machine here, but I'll just try to draw slower and see how it goes. So you can, you know, just put everyone in a good old t-shirt, right? But then what about, you know, putting stuff on it and then, or when it just isn't appropriate, it's like, well, I have a person who's the dean of a school here, probably not coming to work in a t-shirt. And
probably not.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. I mean, do you ever look up get fashion catalogs or like clothing catalogs from like Sears and Macy's and Delia's and Abercrombie and Fitch or anything like that?
I do.
Those websites.
I think part of the challenge is like I'll sit around and I'll put in maybe anywhere from like 5 minutes to 100 minutes into a drawing, like maybe while I'm, you know, relaxing, watching TV with my wife or whatnot. And But sometimes when I'm doing that practice, I don't always, I don't know, like maybe it's a, having a, those kind of materials more at the ready, because when I'm actually putting out a comic, I often start leaning on different crutches that, they're sort of like this really oversimplified clothing vocabulary that I've built up, you know, jeans, t-shirts, long sleeve shirts, turtlenecks, certain types of blouses for women, not a whole lot of variety, right? So then I may go like in a bit of a fantasy direction now and then, as far as someone who's a little more barbaric or heroic or something, but that's pretty rare.
So you never done anything like where you like try to think about like an outfit for a character where you get to draw like a certain kind of line or anything like that?
No, I haven't yet.
Because that's something I like to do. That's a way I like to challenge myself. Is like, for instance, okay, so I'm doing this thing on my screen right now, where I'm a big fan of trying to define the contour of a figure with one line if possible. So like, I'll go back to my inking layer. So if I can do one swooshy line like that to define my character, I feel really happy. It feels really good to me for some reason. And then so then I say, well, I really like drawing these swooshy lines. So what kind of outfits can I look up to figure out swooshy lines? And I was looking at, I went to Delia's, the college girl, I'll write down the name. It's a clothing. Delia's. Come on, S. It's a college clothing company, right? They really pretty much market to like 19-year-old girls. And so I was like, well, what are they wearing this year? And I found this like scoop neck thing that this girl's wearing with like these big blousy at the elbow sleeves, but it's like knit. And then like, of course, like the elastic band at the mid forearm. Kind of reminded me of, like the Flashdance kind of look. Remember that?
Oh yeah, totally.
And I was like, bingo, there it is. That looks really, you know, I get to draw this kind of line now, this like swooshy thing. And so I was working on some character designs for a new project, and sure enough. And then when I was working on the character, I got down to the waist area, and then I, you know, I'm rendering her legs, and I'm like, well, I wonder what kind of things I can do to get those swooshy lines on the legs. And so, you know, pencil them in. Oh God, these feet are terrible. And then I thought, well, cool. If she's already got this flash dance thing going on here, not an arrow. I got to draw slowly while doing this in Kinect. I thought, well, why not just go all out, do some big old leg warmers, some swooshy lines there. And I really liked the look that I came
up with. Oh, yeah. It's really nice.
So it all came out of, I mean, it literally just came out of like, okay, what can I draw that has swooshy lines, right? And so she had like, I get to do like this outer contour, like I like to do. And so sometimes that'll give me inspiration for clothing, right? It's like nice. Where to investigate into clothing. Because like, I'll tell you, a lot of the stuff that was on the...
Look at a giant list of clothing and think, well, what fits? But so you're going into it with almost like a sort of a design constraint that you want to have the swooshy look for this character. So because it's somehow informing your feeling you're getting from them, you know, whereas you maybe... versus, you know, something that's more fuzzy or sharp and plate looking or spiky, stuff like that.
Or, yeah, right. I could also just as easily do like, you know, try to draw another female figure, female-ish figure. This is running really slow and sluggish. So, you know, if I was going to do, say, like an older woman character, somebody in her, like, you know, late 30s, early 40s, maybe more of a power suit kind of thing, then, yeah, I'm going to think of sharp lines. But I'm also going to think about graceful contour, right? And then I'm going to go, oh, well, maybe I'll look up some dresses, and I'll find something with a nice kind of, like, bunched up scoop neck thing, sleeveless, split here, get the nice straight shoulder look, but then... And then, oh, I'm running out of board here. But then perhaps, you know, let's look at what kind of shoes could go along with this kind of thing. Oh, maybe some kind of like high-legged boot. But that's how I'll get my initial inspiration is I'll think, okay, so older woman, I'm going to think of sharp lines and then a long contour. And then for this younger girl, I thought, well, swooshy, blousy. What can I find that's help? Like as you were saying, like reduce my number of choices.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Finding some kind of constraint. Cause otherwise you do a Google image search, or I actually have, I don't know, a few years back, I was really funding a lot of different, I would buy a lot of resource material for a video game I was working on and inspiring the look of different things. And I was probably investing too much time in these different side pursuits as opposed to, you know, doing that versus making the darn game. But I have built up this pretty sweet library of different cultural reference material and, anything from sort of societies of, you know, desert lands to Gothic architecture to just a book talking about architecture to, I don't know, different animals of the jungle, stuff like that, where it's, I don't have to do a Google image search. I've got sort of this, an interesting library of things that, it's not, you know, too insane. It's a couple of bookshelves, no big deal, but, it's helpful source material. But at the same time, in one area it's weak is fashion specifically. But I can see that being really helpful if you're going to say, well, all right, this character, I really want to emphasize their mellow, happy nature. And going to go with some clothing that's not all sleek and tight, but it's going to be, you know, loose but flowy.
Right. Well, here's a classic character we can talk about who had... how long it takes before you recognize him with my slow, crude drawing.
Shaggy?
Yeah, exactly. And look at his clothing style, right?
Yeah. That is...
You got the V-neck shirt.
My clothing vocabulary.
What's that?
That's 80% of my clothing vocabulary.
The long, kind of loose V-neck shirt?
Yep.
But I'm going to have to actually erase my canvas here because I'm running out of space. It's funny. You don't think about this. Maybe, I don't know. I'm not going to say you don't think about this, but it's an easy thing to overlook is that it's going to come out of the character's personality, right? And even the way two different characters wear suits is going to be different. So... and then you got to think about the body type. Is this going to be a fairly rotund character?
Mm-hmm.
And is this character who's rotund, do they accept the fact that they're rotund and wear appropriately sized clothing? Or are they, you know, wearing the clothes from like 7 years ago before they gained all this weight? And so is it going to be something where it's very tight? Everything's going to be bunched up at the corners.
Sure. Yep. Not quite long enough.
Stretched. Yeah, not quite long enough, right. Which is going to say something different about the character than if they wear something that's actually like tailor-made for them, right? Versus, let's go to this one, where it'd be more... Oops. Let me go in. This is more, now I've got the Kingpin from Marvel Comics, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Kingpin is obviously a comfortably dressed, confident person.
Yeah, and they always did like a big case out of making those slacks very drapey. So, yeah, two totally different ways to go about it, and it all depends on what the character's inner life is, right?
Yep.
So another thing that Amy Kim Kibuishi once told me is layering, like think in layers. And that really unlocked a lot of stuff for me. It's like, yeah, of course. I mean, people wear layers and we should be thinking about how these layers interact with one another. Right.
Absolutely.
it's ducking you again, Rob. So what'd you say?
Oh, absolutely. It basically breaking down the larger problem into smaller ones and using something that you do know to help discover the things that you don't know. It's like it's a foundation to reach off into research and filtering what could be a sea of puzzling information.
But is it so for you, is it like it's an imagination thing? It's like, well, I don't know what to put on this person, so I'm just going to go to my default and it's going to be t-shirts and jeans.
It's sort of or I'll just sort of imagine a rough approximation of the power suit. I mean, so if I am doing a power suit, I will sort of do it's like part power, part suit, part tight shirt, not quite a suit. They're wearing a collared shirt underneath something that looks maybe like it came out of the Fifth Element movie, not necessarily. I'm not trying to be overly harsh about, like, you know, my drawing or whatever. It just, I know I need to research these things more and expand my vocabulary there. I'm leaning too much on my cheats or crutches or things that just don't fully represent the character, where I realize now that this clothing is information that could be reinforcing the character and helping me achieve my communication goals as a storyteller.
This is going to seem neurotic, and I know my student.
Sorry. Excuse me.
What's that?
No, I was a little worried about a visiting cat that jumped on a keyboard. Anyway, situation solved.
Oh, okay. Awesome. So nothing's damaged.
Thankfully, if I'm still here, it's all good. So, all right.
Okay. No, this is going to really seem good. A little neurotic. And I know this always bums my students out when I tell them this, but, you know, the whole principle of drawing through, right? So it's like, if you're going to draw, I'm going to do this slowly because it makes Adobe Connect mad. Let's say you're going to draw the crossbody punch and you start with your good old stick figure and build out. Here's the shoulder, here's the upper arm, there's the arm crossing over, and then this arm comes back, and then there's the wind-up arm, right? And they tell you in those How to Draw books to draw through your character, because otherwise you're going to misplace elements, or you run the risk of misplacing elements, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely. You have a 3D shape in space as opposed to your flattened, over-summarized version of that shape.
So then, when you ink it, you know where everything is supposed to be. So I can put the character's head here, and I know not to draw the rest of that arm there, right? And then I've got a reasonable approximation of a human figure throwing a punch.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, this would be the leg that goes back. See, this is another reason to draw through. Anyway, so here's where my students go, oh, come on, you're kidding me, is when I'm doing my pencils, I'll actually pencil the anatomy like this, and then I'll put mm-hmm. the clothing on top of it like I did here in red, and then I'll put layers. So after I'll draw the whole shirt, and then if he was wearing a vest, I'll go ahead and put the vest over top, because now I know that this pocket here is going to be covered up, so I don't need to worry about that. And then I'll go ahead and put the suit jacket on. And this helps me imagine how these different layers are interacting. And now I know that, okay, those lines need to be inked. These lines need to be inked, and so on. The same kind of principle as you think about when you're drawing through in your pencil stage with the anatomy, I think about when I'm drawing the layers of clothing. So I'll actually draw all those layers. And I know that, again, it sounds super neurotic, but it's a way to sort of safeguard myself. Good planning.
That it, yeah. It actually, I don't think that's neurotic at all. And it's, I would imagine depending on the kind of style you're going for, depending on your familiarity with the subject. I mean, perhaps if you've already drawn that gentleman in the suit, you really know, oh, okay, this is how you can have a convincing feel without worrying about those details, perhaps. But that's really cool. I think I'll start doing that to gain that familiarity, because I certainly don't have it yet.
It helped me a lot with being able to visualize how fabric interacts with bodies. And I mean, and you do have, or at least you've looked at Bern Hogarth's Dynamic Wrinkles and Drapery, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great resource for at least understanding how the different folds interact at different points of the body, right? Mm-hmm. So you know that, like, you know, the folds on the pant leg are going to go in such a way. The knee is bent forward, right? So, but yeah, but I think like penciling each layer of the clothing helps a lot to help you visualize that, and also begin to think about, like we were talking about a second ago, in components. So it's breaking down the realms of concern, making it a little bit more manageable.
I love relearning that lesson pretty much constantly. This is a nice, a perfect example of that, because you can understand, well, okay, cool. I have to break things down into separate concerns and how are these things affecting one another. But then if you don't quite have the vocabulary, or if you're not sort of stopping and reminding yourself of the vocabulary you already have to help break the problem down, it, obviously it will be hard to, you know, you're harder to accomplish that same goal. Interesting.
Here's one of the ones I've had a lot of trouble with in the past. Mm. Is the looking up at the face shot.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of things going on here. One, you have to turn a head around inside of your mind. You got the other eye syndrome, right? The hardest thing to draw, a lot of artists say, is the other eye.
Yep.
And then the distortion that happens on the lower part of the face. Well, here's that nose. The distortion that happens on the lower part of the face as you progress it down toward the chin. And then also, I mean, it's like, okay, we can see in our head a jawline of a character and the way it relates to the neck. But now we've got a whole new problem here, because the jaw is actually interacting with the neck. We see that connection a little bit more clearly, where the jaw actually becomes part of the neck. And so when we get to the inking layer, or the inking stage, I'll start inking this. Is this showing up okay?
Oh, it's showing up, yeah, very well. I mean, there's also a little bit of foreshortening going on the mouth, because it's, let's see, so the characters, I don't know which, yeah, speaking in left and right, essentially that character's left side of it, of his mouth, is far closer to us.
Mm-hmm.
And you've represented that accurately, because it is a part of the volume of the head, and then, and that portion of the head is closer and jutting out. And so, I mean, it makes sense to have the mouth, gaping more on that side. And that's not a necessarily, right, either. And then how the jaw also, the jaw can essentially disappear into the neck.
Exactly. Where you, I mean, because see, if I drew
standing out, but I think it depends on the lighting and stuff, where
it does, sure, depend on the lighting.
Sometimes the main part of the chin that you end up really getting to see is like that corner. And then maybe like where the bone coming in a little bit, and then all of a sudden it depending on the detail of your line work and all that, all of a sudden this whole section in here may be far less emphasized.
Yeah. And like, so when you looking at the face straight on, it's like you want to draw that lower jaw clearly defined with a line, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you need that. I mean, right? That looks natural. But if I were to do that here, look how weird that looks, right? Like, cause that line shouldn't be there. That's where we would do it either with shading, like so, or tones. We can create that sense of dimension there, but we, if you define it with a distinct line like that, it just starts looking bizarre.
It does.
Right? So, and turning the head around like that, and then also, even when you work cartoony, so if I were to go, say, like more of a pseudo-manga style, and there's the nose, and here's like a pseudo-Toriyama kind of look. This is another one that my students always have trouble with, is that other eye and how I'll draw. This is the great thing about drawing in a digital program like Manga Studio. Because now, okay, that looks perfectly natural to us, or you know, pretty good. It's not great considering, you know, I can do much better than this. But if I get rid of all these lines, and then you were to take and measure this eye versus this eye, look at the distances, right? It's like, it's so hard for us to understand that, yeah, the second eye should be narrower than the first eye. The eye that's farther away from us should be narrower than the first eye. And that's something that I see a lot of people screw up, you know, like beginning cartoonists, they would do. So going back and putting in that face again. Whoa, that's a weird forehead. Right. And so if I were to draw the eye the same width as this, right? Whoops. Roughly. I gotta erase the other one first. There we go. Suddenly we lose all sense of dimension there, right?
Yeah, and some art styles call for that. I mean, so was it, I don't know, what is the history on using perspective? Is it something that artists started to do and then we lost during the Dark Ages or whatnot? But I remember, you know, like medieval tapestries, a lot of,
right, yeah,
a lot of the renderings you see of the human figure, it's, I mean, it's as if everyone's been run over by a steamrolling machine, which hadn't even been invented yet, because, you know, it's everyone's flat. It's almost like everyone's part flounder.
Right.
So, yeah, two eyes on one side of their head.
And then Picasso found that again.
Yeah, oh, you're right. Yep. And
but
it's,
yeah,
almost,
I mean,
like,
it depends on the art style that you're going for. What?
Oh, no, the it's almost like the summary of a face, as opposed to, and the symbols that comprise the face, not actually the perception of people in a 3D volume space, which we typically perceive, if, you know, yeah, sighted people with two eyes experience all the time.
Yep. So that's one of the ones, the other eye and the upshot. And then I want to kick it back to you. What's another one that gives you issues?
Oh gosh. I mean, fashion is really kind of a mega one. And then obviously, I mean, it's what else gives me issues? It's a little bit meta, but thinking about source material and flavoring, I think that some of that is a cultural thing, where I almost, I can be comfortable just working out of my imagination, but I see and recognize through observing how other artists work, how important it can be to work with source material, such as pictures of buildings going around town. Like I remember, seeing part of the making of Scott Pilgrim, and how Brian Lee O'Malley went around to the locations and he took a lot of photographs. And yep. I'm not sure the technique he used to then bring them into the book, but they are very accurately representative of their subject material. So anything from locations to specific logos on things and shirts and that, where it's like, how much of the real world do I include or not? And so far, yeah. I've really just said, well, it's all imagination. I just kind of fill in blanks and or leave blanks.
One of the things that, and again, see, I always feel like I have to apologize for this. I always feel like I have to say, like, I know this is really crazy and neurotic, but everything is an opportunity in your comic. When you're building a world, everything's an opportunity for thinking about what is it and why is it? So like in the front, there was a bunch of different cars. I had scenes where the characters are going to be driving cars. And then there was the natural question, what kind of car would this particular character drive? And so if it's Thirsty and Knox, my two teenage boys, they're not going to have a nice car. And if they do, there's got to be a reason for that. There's got to be, okay, why would they have a nice car? And that has to be a story point, or I have to address it somehow. It can't just be, well, he just happens to drive a Dodge Viper. That's all. Because I like to draw Dodge Vipers, you know. Stories have to have a plausibility to them to some extent. So everything was an opportunity to ask, why would they have this? So like even like the design of Rex's apartment, I decided for a sparsely decorated apartment because this is an old man who has like sufficient pain in his past. And I thought he should have very few things to remind him of that past. But then I thought, well, he's also kind of an old grandpa character, so he should have an old grandpa car. And so that's when I decided, okay, well, what kind of cars do I think of when I think of old grandpa cars? Oh, I think of an old Delta 88 from like 1976. Mm. And so then I just looked up, you know, Google image search and found as many pictures as I could of an old Delta 88.
That's funny.
Which has a really nutty grill, by the way.
Regency.
What's that?
I used to drive an old Delta 98.
Oh, man, really? That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Love those cars, those big boxy cars. I mean, it was partially because I... Go ahead, Rob.
Sorry. I was really feeling your statement as far as loving those old boxy cars. And had a really... some cars, they end up being on either end of the spectrum. Both the older generation has them and the young kids have them. It's kind of a funny way where that can work out because those cars probably have been around a while. So they're more affordable for, youngsters. And then at the same time, some folks who are aware of, being in tightly control of their budget or whatnot, they're going to hold on to those cars and keep them around. So it's kind of funny. Two ends of the spectrum there.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I love those cars just because those are the cars that I rode around in when I was a really little kid. It's from that time of my life, you know, being like an 8 year old, that was the kind of cars that my parents and grandparents had. Plus I think they're fun to draw. The old Delta 88 in particular had a really nutty grill that made it very difficult to draw in perspective. But then I think about it in another comic I did called The Replacements. I had one of the protagonists was an uptight, somewhat harried museum registrar named Helen, and it was took place in modern day. So I thought, well, what kind of car would she drive? Well, she'd probably drive one of those new VW Beetles. So, you know, you get a bunch of reference material on that. So everything is an opportunity to express something about the characters in the world, right? And so, you know, The Replacements took place in the Southwest. I was living in the Southwest at the time, so it was super easy to get reference material. I just went for walks, right? But so it was not to just, you know, Southwest, that means you got palm trees.
Oh, yeah. Which are different flora and fauna.
But there's different kinds of palm trees. There's the tall, skinny ones. But then if you've ever been to the Southwest, there's ones that are shaped kind of like pineapple-y, and they have a really rough bark. And the fronds stick up more like the top of a pineapple. And like this would be like the size of a person next to it.
Oh, yeah.
And unless I went to go on walks and do my research and look at this stuff, you know, I wouldn't know that there's different kinds of palm trees. I would think of this kind all the time. The tall, skinny ones that we see like on desert islands, the coconuts, like in Gilligan's Island, right? But there was all kinds of different palm trees. And then also like, okay, well, what kind of small shrubbery do you see in the desert? And like, so when we think of shrubbery in the Midwest, we think of more of like a wheat-like grassy stalk, but everything in the desert is very gnarled. So I learned very quickly that, oh, I'm going to have to make sure that whenever I draw a shrubbery, I'm using very angular, oh, I got my stroke correction on, very angular lines to represent these gnarled and twisted branches, or like a Palo Verde tree. I don't know if you ever seen, you've probably seen those, right, Rob? Those greenish, they got like a green smooth bark, but like the branches are all twisted out of craziness like this.
Interesting. Reminds me of a banyan tree, but not.
Yeah, it is a little bit like that.
Cool.
So, yeah, everything is an opportunity to express the personality of your story, right? So, yeah, I mean, when, like what you're talking about with Brian Lee O'Malley does, I think that that's probably what more storytellers should do. What kind of shoes do the characters wear? What's that?
I'm starting to pick up on that. Yet another thing as far as tackling the next chapter of my story and realizing that there's it's interesting to tackle something that's a little bit conceptual, right? Where some stories, it's an older movie, but like Gattaca or something where, yeah, I mean, I guess there is a lot of explicit, specific examples of their society, but in some ways it's kind of simplified. Or if you think about like Batman the cartoon series, or there's some stylization.
Oh man, like Batman the animated series from the 90s.
Yeah, very simplified.
We got some lag going on, but it was like the Batman animated series from the 90s had like that Art Deco 1930s kind of look in the first couple seasons. And I mean, it evolved and it morphed, but yeah, continue. I'm sorry, Rob.
No worries. I mean, yeah, I would say it had a very specific Art Deco from time to time, but it also went sort of simple shapes and it's a bit futuristic, but then it had that retro flavor too with occasional specific Art Deco examples. But I don't think they painstakingly rendered, from what I remember, there was a lot of abstraction in the background going on. So you would have scenes that I mean, they had relevant details, but there was a lot of detail left out on purpose. And that has a different effect on a story. And I guess I'm my main comic that I've put the most time into, I've taken that approach, but I'm seeing how it shows some weaknesses as far as the what if you want to say something specific about your characters, but just based on their kind of shoes, like you said, or, perhaps not just that they wear a t-shirt. So what's on it? What band do they like? More specific than the ones that I make up in the story, right? I mean, a little more of the feel of the world and time they're from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm doing two different kinds of boots right now. Just different kind of boots tell you an awful lot.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah, totally.
Combat boot, or like, so like, you know, lace up combat boot, or you know, like more like a riding boot. And then Thirsty Knox and Gibson in the front all had very different shoes to represent the different kinds of boys they were. So Thirsty wore the Chuck Taylors, I think they were high tops, actually. He wore the Chuck Taylor high tops, which is like a standby nerd shoe, right? That's to say, like, okay, he's a nerdy kid. He's kind of cool, but he's kind of not. Knox wore the more traditional kind of Reeboks casual athletic shoes. Mm. Kind of padded top. And Gibson wore Vans. Remember Vans?
I do.
To emphasize the fact that, he's a skater kid. Kind of a hipster kid who a proto hipster, pre hipster, who you know likes the Beastie Boys and likes playing the Tony Hawk video games. So yeah, just three different kinds of shoes that were all chosen specifically to emphasize that particular aspect of the character. Now it's not something where I'm thinking that the readers are going to necessarily pick up on it, but maybe some did. But it contributes. It's all contributing pieces, right?
Exactly. It's not like someone has to look for every single detail. And so I suppose part of the puzzle for me is that is a challenge, is now that I'm caring more about that, what details to include and which ones to not worry about, right? Because essentially I'm saying I want to worry about more details, but I know it would be not that I'm it'd be a little bit incongruous, and it would probably slow me down too much if I started all of a sudden caring about every single thing, every single character war to a high, high degree. I would like to build up to it and, see what level of detail makes sense. How about you, Jersey?
Turn it back on me?
Yeah.
Oh man, I'll tell you what, hair.
Oh, hair.
Hair is a big one.
Yep.
I like drawing hair, but I don't really feel like I got the hang of it yet. And I wish Manga Studio was working a little bit faster than this. Playing with different hair types. And one of the ways that I'm getting around it right now, and this comes from taking some lead into art courses with people like Krishna Sadasvam and Brandon Dayton and Tyler James, is not that that was an ad. I'm just this is something that I picked up from them and I was really grateful for it, was thinking in shapes. So like if I started with, I'm going to go back to my pencil layer, and I really like when I'm drawing characters' hair, like I'll take character Galen from the front, for instance, who has a very angular face, very dour expression. It's basically the starting point of Galen. But what counterbalances that severe look and attitude and disposition, and actually he's always got his lids half down. That's one of the rules of Galen. is he has this beautiful swooshy hair. So it's all smooth lines on his hair to emphasize that, yes, he is very severe and he's very unpleasant, but he's very beautiful. Right? So, I mean, I like doing that part of the hair. I like doing, like, even on characters like Thirsty, where it's all these little curly lines that make up his hair. But I'm always thinking about, like, the contours and how those contours contribute to the shape, but I never really think about the shape itself. So when I'm working on this new batch of character designs that I'm working on right now for a project, I'm starting to go, okay, I'll take the pencil layer and then I'll just go like this.
Or
this. And I'll just break it down into, okay, instead of thinking about the lines, think about how the actual mass will interact with the face to give me a sense of what I want to do with it first. And this is something Krishna taught us in his Creating Crazy Characters class, right?
Oh,
was start with
on me. I haven't thought of my characters the same since.
Yep.
It's that outline, I realize it, It's just that as far as picking one thing to be concerned about that helps build a foundation for better communicating the character, it's wonderful. It's interesting that you're pointing out that you can use that to tackle hair also.
There's a character that I designed for the book who has roughly this kind of hairstyle. And it came out of just playing around with putting different triangles, circles, and squares on people's heads. And then I got to do all those little swooshy lines that I like. But the inspiration.
Oh, shape, nice.
It started with that shape, right? So then I just drew a bunch of circles. Oops, man, the circles are not coming together. If I work slowly, it's fine. You know, I'll start with a circle or whatever their general head shape is. Like, oh, I want them to have a narrow head, or I want them to have more of, you know, a cherubic face, pronounced cheeks, whichever. I'll start there, and then I'll go in and say, okay, let's try putting a square on it. Let's try putting, you know, this kind of triangle, maybe this kind of triangle, that kind of triangle, and just be playful with it. And just see what jumps out at me, and then start throwing some lines over top of that to get my.
Yeah, that's very cool. It's a good approach. So again, looking for something that reinforces the character. So do you think that would be like your primary method now, or would you ever go back to building things up with incremental swooshing?
No, I mean, it, like you were saying about Krishna's class, it's like seeing the world in a whole new way. I mean, I can't not see it that way now, right? So, I was working on a character design where I came up with this kind of hair configuration, and she had kind of like these messy bangs, and then these long pieces here, and it was kind of messy in the back. And it came out of doing this kind of shape, kind of a triangle coming off the back of the head, right? That's what I started with. And then I thought, well, you know, maybe I got this kind of whim to say, well, maybe she needs curly hair. This particular character, maybe, I mean, she's got kind of like a certain aspect to her personality that's a little bit more like tightly wound. And maybe I can emphasize that through a curly hair. And I couldn't get curly hair to do the same thing and follow that same shape of that triangle coming off of the back of the head the same way where it felt appropriate to the shape. Does that make sense? It's like I was so convinced that, okay, this point coming off the back of the head is the way to do it. That's what looks right for this particular character. And to do that, I need her hair to be relatively straight. It can be wavy, but relatively straight. It can't be, if I do it like this, then she looks like she's got like a bad perm.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Horribly wrong. It is interesting. Like that shape sort of said somehow the physics of hair wouldn't just curly hair just wouldn't do that, really. I mean, you
at least,
could
at least not without looking like it was intentionally styled to make dad angry or something, right?
Sure. Well, I mean, speaking of the fifth element, Roddy, what was his name? Anyway, he had that super huge curly cone, like a unicorn horn.
Yeah.
Firm thing.
Yeah. Well, what's that actor's name? It's something Tucker, isn't it?
Tucker. Chris Tucker. Thank you. Chris Tucker.
But Chris Tucker, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's one way I've begun to reinvestigate the whole idea. Because I used to just start, like I was showing you before, when I was working with character designs, I would just start by throwing strands down instead of shapes down. And Krishna got me thinking about backing up and sort of doing the squint test on things to give me more ideas. And again, it's a low risk way to investigate. Like, you know, it's like sometimes I see this happening with my teenage students. They get a little bit disheartened by the fact that, oh, you mean you got to draw a page three times? Like, not only do you have to draw a page three times sometimes, but you got to draw a character like 50, 60 times before you even feel like you got them right. Just look in a concept art book. You see all these different versions of a character before they land on the one that's right. And that can be kind of disheartening when you're sitting down to a page, like, I'm going to start designing some characters. Well, the great thing about guys like Krishna is they teach us that, well, don't do the final one, do a whole bunch of this kind of loose stuff to whittle down to the final 10 candidates and then take it from there. Right.
It's a really good approach. Make it inexpensive to try and explore.
Yep.
And, that's another area that I would, that I'm really hoping to practice and improve is, maybe it's sort of taking Krishna's shape approach and then starting to apply it to more things besides character design, but sort of take that fast and loose, use shapes to assemble scenes even, and then choose where I want to expound and add some more detail from there. because I think a lot of concept artists. Yeah, thumbnailing or even even a little bit beyond thumbnailing. Very much like a concept artist. I see a lot of examples of that kind of thing in Imagine Effects.
Imagine Effects.
That is a magazine for sci-fi and fantasy art. It has a lot of a lot of people who digitally paint and physically paint. And it sort of, it celebrates both, you know, people that are practicing, you know, early professionals, people who have very established careers. It does a lot of, sort of, a lot of tutorials and whatnot. It's a magazine out of the UK, where evidently the UK seems to somehow fund more variety of interesting magazines I like. And it's not like I go around buying them all. Imagine Effects is pretty much the only one, but that I still purchase or whatnot, but because they're kind of expensive to import, but I don't know. It's not too bad if you subscribe to, you know, get a discount off of the newsstand price. But anyway, I've been a reader of that for a while, and there's a lot of examples of people who use rapid, sketchy approaches to explore ideas. And that's not just limited to character shape and style.
Hmm. Yeah. I think Krishna's look at things in terms of shape. And we should actually mention real quick that we should make a plug for the Polytechnicast that you did with Krishna, because that was really good.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
So tell us about that one that you did.
Okay. Let's see. Krishna and I took a bit of time to talk about his approach to user interface design for PC Weenies, because I noticed, being into both comics, web comics, and UI design, that just before I got to know Krishna even, that this is a guy who keeps refining how he's presenting his comics. He's caring about the UI and the experience on his site. And it was just fun to watch, like, over a course of a few years. I mean, he does a bunch of iterations every year, and it just keeps getting tighter and tighter, more refined. And I think it flexes too, as his goals tend to change, like perhaps as far as how he's, what kind of ad arrangements he currently has and whatnot. Anyways, it was neat to sort of get into it also, because he had recently done some updates to try to help new readers get just basically address the needs of new readers in ways that he hadn't before. So to bring them into a story and whatnot. Anyway, it was a lot of fun to delve into that.
So on top of also being like a great teacher and conceptual artist, he's also an awesome guy to talk to pick his brain about UI design and UX design. Super smart guy. Great episode of the Polytechnicast. We should include a link in the show notes. I just pulled up on the screen the Thurston Knox and Gibson redesigns that I did recently, where I was thinking a lot about these different kinds of ways that clothing interacts and body language. And then also what kind of lines they use and what kind of hairstyles, like how to emphasize the difference between their personalities with just the lines I use to render their hair. So, you know, you look at Gibson and it's all about balloony, blousey shapes, right? And his shirt overlaps his pants to emphasize that it's a bigger shirt than what the other boys are wearing. Look at how Knox's shirt is actually sucked right into the contour of his body, right? Mm-hmm. It's a tight shirt, but then it's got like the big bulges at the top with a little bit of the flare out to emphasize that it's tight, but like it's also emphasizing that like that's muscle there, kids. That's not just like a blousy sleeve. It's like it's snug around him. Whereas Thirsty is somewhere in between. It's following his contour, but also the sleeves just drape off like Gibson's, whereas Knox's are really tight. Knox is more comfortable with his body than the other two boys. And that's what I wanted to emphasize with him. His body language is relaxed, slumping arms, leaning forward with the neck, but with a smile, with a engaging look to some degree. Receptive. Thirsty is more withdrawn, even though he's got the same. His shoulders are more drooped. He's not relaxed. He is guarded. Whereas Gibson is expansive, right, with his pose. So yeah, all this stuff is deliberate, right? At least you try to be.
It is, oh, and go ahead.
Oh, the last point I wanted to make is that Gibson's Shark Attack shirt, right? And that also emphasizes that this is a guy who is not cool. He is an exhibitionist. He thinks he's being funny. And we all knew that guy who wore the Who Farted or Shark Attack shirt. But okay, sorry, done.
No, totally. No, I don't know. I like seeing these examples, and I look forward to trying to add more of those details. I'm not trying to convey like I blew off all sort of specific concern with trying to design my characters, but I have a more refined palette now as far as my tastes have changed. And basically it's like leaving money on the table. These character designs could be doing more for my storytelling.
Yeah. Well, we've got about like 3 seconds of latency going on with this video. I'm going to stop sharing my thing, and we should wrap up anyway pretty soon here. But it was a fun experiment. Yeah, we could stop sharing our screens, and then we can do this. We can just make this video bigger, and everybody can see our big, happy faces. Yep, boom. So, hey, Rob, this was fun. It was fun doing a little bit of drawing with you, even if there was a few technological hiccups. We're still here, at least. And we should take this moment to say that this episode is going to be airing on Friday, so that means that we have time to say to everybody, there's only a few days left to sign up for Tyler James's workshop, The Absolute Consense. That's at leanintoart/workshops. That's the only way that the only means we have for you to support what we're doing. If you enjoy this, if you like the podcast that we put together, a great way to help pat us on the back and keep this thing going is to sign up for one of our workshops. And the next one is with Tyler James, who is an accomplished cartoonist, a lot of hard-won knowledge about conventioning. If you've ever been to a convention, like Rob and I have, and spent a lot of money to go and experience all that fun, you may have wondered, boy, how I wish I could get more out of this thing. This is a great workshop for that. We just did a test run. We updated the post at leanintoart.com/workshops with a video teaser. And in that video teaser, there's like this 9-step plan that Tyler used to basically make money on the show before he even went to the show. And it's not a sleazy thing that he did. It's a very logical, clear thinking way to leverage his value as a cartoonist with his fans to help sort of get pre-orders going on the show. So by the time he got there, not only did he have sales already made, but he managed to create a buzz around his table, which resulted in more sales. So that's all in the preview video, but there's 50 more things that he has to share on how to maximize your experience at a convention, right?
It's wild. It's one of those things where I think a lot of us as artists can, I mean, we did this whole podcast this time about trying to talk about, well, what are we trying to improve or tackle? What's difficult in communicating our visual art and drawing? What subjects, and we talked a lot about storytelling and how you want to do that. And so we're building up certain strengths, but a lot of us will have, well, a big weaknesses when it comes to business. And how do you tackle that side of it when you want to do your art as a service? You see it working. You see others successful at it. And basically Tyler is someone who has put a lot of work into both figuring out a way that works for himself, but also wondering how that functions, and he has put together a workshop that asks those questions to help you build your own approach for accomplishing that.
That's a good way of putting it. It's not a simple like just do this, kids. He really is demonstrating how thinking about your art as a business will help make your convention experiences better. And it's not just as simple as, well, that guy's got a vertical banner, I just got to get a vertical banner, that's all. No, it's thinking about what is your specific value as a cartoonist, and here's some thinking strategies, here's some really good questions to ask so that you can find your own unique. Like going back to Krishna again, one of the things that Krishna likes to talk about is Seth Godin's Purple Cow principle. How do you stand out? How do you make yourself unique? How do you differentiate yourself, especially at a Comic-Con where everybody else there is a cartoonist, right? So... yeah, I've sat through the dry run of the workshop. It's an amazing workshop. So yeah, only a couple days left to sign up at leanintoart.com/workshops. And it'd be a great way to support the show and get some amazing material that comes with, if you can't make it to the live event, you get a download of the video with no DRM, never expires. So, all right, yeah. I want to keep that one a little bit on the brief side because we've been pushing it pretty hard.
I know. Everybody who's tempting fate with Adobe Connect. fair point, Jersey. I mean, it's been fair enough, whatever. But obviously, yeah. We've had lag. We want this video to succeed and get out into your hands.
Yes. But the workshop's going to go great because we're not going to be straining Adobe Connect as much with like two live drawing feeds plus two video feeds. So
exactly. Single presenter, not that big of a deal for.
Right. But thank you, Rob. And I want to give you a chance to, is there anything else that's going on that you want to point people at that you're excited about?
Oh,
we never plug ourselves. Besides, we plug the workshops, but we never say anything else that we're doing, you know?
I'm hard at work working on some workshops that I want to share more about in the future. And in a nutshell, I've got a workshop that we've teased a while back about making a video game, and I've got one already in existence that's about designing a video game based on your comic. So you could take a narrative and use that as a basis for a game design. Well, this expounds that into not just that initial planning. It makes it into, well, here's how you can build a game. And I've tried to make that like extra fun and unique because I made the workshop as a game also. So
still looking forward to this. Very excited about it, Rob. So hopefully that'll be next month in the next 60 days. How about that?
Exactly. I'm working hard at it, and you know, it's like a we sell no wine before it's time kind of thing, to borrow an old cliche marketing phrase.
Man, that is not a comparison that you want to make. Yeah. Your workshop is not going to be like Paul Masson wine. I guarantee it.
Is that bad wine? I don't know.
Oh yeah, Paul Masson. I got it once. Mark Rudolph and I, when we were recording an Art and Story podcast years ago, we got a bottle of Paul Masson because of the Orson Welles commercials where we will sell no wine before it's time. And well, some people might enjoy it. I didn't enjoy it all that much.
It's not meant to be a. Anyway, they had a good.
Let's get out of here before we start defaming people. We don't want to do that.
Exactly.
It's a lovely product. Well, yes, we will be updating everybody with information about that workshop in the near future. And I don't have anything else that I...
Yeah, you always have stuff going on at comicsaregreat.com, though.
There we go.
It's always worth checking out the stream of awesome and interesting things that you're doing on that interview-based format show that also has a really good local flavor because of the Ann Arbor District Library and all that kind of stuff. It's an example that hopefully more libraries will get inspired from and whatnot.
I hope so. Awesome. I'm doing a talk on it actually at the Michigan Library Association conference this summer sometime. I forget when, but I'm going to be moderating a panel on what we've done at AADL. So hopefully I'll get some more libraries, at least in the Michigan area, on board. But thank you everybody for downloading and listening and playing along. Until next time, I've been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and leanintoart.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger, also of leanintoart.com and interactivestoryteller.com. Put a dash in there and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, dash bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.